You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, you might sign kids up to play sports for a lot of reasons. They get to exercise, learn about teamwork, maybe make some friends along the way. But our next guest says youth sports have changed a lot over the last few decades. She's been an athlete, the parent of an athlete, and a coach herself. She says there's less of an emphasis now on fun, a bigger focus on competitiveness, driven in part by the multi-billion dollar youth sports industry and by college sports. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience in youth sports lately? Has it become too expensive? Has your family been priced out of some sports completely? Are we grown-ups putting too much pressure on kids to compete at a high level instead of having fun and getting exercise? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Linda Flanagan is a freelance journalist, researcher, and former track and cross-country coach. Her new book is Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. Linda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
In your book, Linda, you highlight a lot of the problems with youth sports. We'll get to those, but in a lot of ways, you really love athletics, at least their potential. Before we get to the negatives, what would a good, positive youth sports culture look like?
Oh, it would look reasonable. It would involve a supportive coach who looked out for all the kids on the team, was gearing the practices up so that they suited the kids' developmental level. They would be moderate. They would be age appropriate. So you wouldn't have a five-year-old having practices 4 days a week and two games on the weekend. There would be opportunities for growth, development, to learn about teamwork. The coach would, a certain of older kids would help them understand the application of what they've learned on the team to the rest of their life. So they would learn beyond, the X's and O's of a game. I mean, there's all kinds of wonderful things you can learn from sports. And I'm a big believer in what they can do for you. And I've benefited so much myself. It's just that they've changed so much that we've lost a lot of that.
Let's get into some of those changes. One of them I mentioned is the money. Can you talk about just how much that has exploded as an industry?
Yes, it's really kind of shocking that it is a $19 billion industry. That's B, billion. And to put it in context, the NFL is a $15 billion industry. And it has just taken off. Since 2010, it has grown 90%. And, you know, the long and short of it is there's a lot of people profiting off your family.
Now, a big part of the problem is, and I'll admit, I'm a sports parent myself. I wasn't the worst one out there, but there are things I wish I had done differently. What is driving parents to define ourselves in a way by what our kids do out there on some sort of athletic field?
You know, it's such an interesting question, and it really does go beyond athletics, but sports are so popular. They're the most popular extracurricular activity that's where we see it the most. But there's been a change in the perspective, adult perspective on childhood, and a new understanding of what we parents think we owe our kids. As the great journalist Jennifer Senior put it, she said, "Children have moved from our employees to our bosses." And I think that really, that hits home and really resonates, because it can sometimes feel like our kids' schedules and lives are the deciding factor of what the family does. And this is more so than in the past, that parents derive status from their offspring. And I explain more about how that happened in my book.
Are kids still having fun out there, or have we grown-ups in a lot of ways sucked the fun out of the games?
Well, I mean, of course, that's one of the giant problems is that, everyone says this, everyone I spoke to, and I talked to so many people about youth sports and what's changed and where they're headed. And, one of the common themes is that they're just not fun anymore. They're serious. You see third graders with their uniforms and they're tucked in, and there's an official walking by to make sure they have regulation socks on. And it's just become more about adults and, commercialism than it is about, the kids' enjoyment. And, that's a real loss, because some of the kids will quit and never really develop athletically.
Talking to Linda Flanagan about her new book, Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. You can join in with your experiences as a youth athlete now or in the past, as a parent thereof, a coach, a ref. What are you seeing? What do you wish could change about the game, whichever game it is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Linda, before we go to our callers, I want to go to another piece of the puzzle that looms over everything: college sports. How have changes in college sports driven what we're seeing at younger and younger ages?
Well, you know, it's not just changes at sports in colleges and universities. It's also about just broader changes at those institutions overall. I mean, for one, they cost a fortune. Everyone knows that tuition costs are staggeringly high. It's $44,000 a year is the average cost for a national private university. It's $12,000 for a state university. I mean, these are just giant expenses. And on top of that, the perception is that it is much harder for kids to get in. And there's a lot of data to back that up. So there's a lot of insecurity about where kids are going to go. And parents worry that they're not going to be able to go to the same level school that perhaps they went to. And then you have sports. And they seem to offer not exactly a shortcut, but another way in. Because sports, they generally offer more athletes in who have somewhat lower academic standards. There's a streamlined recruiting process. And of course, there's $3.6 billion in scholarship money, athletic scholarship money that, you know, can be dangled before parents to make it seem like, well, this might be the way in.
And that gets to this incentive structure, I think, for parents. Well, if I hold off on my kids starting whatever sport it is until fourth grade and all those other kids are already in since kindergarten, are they behind? Are they going to be able to keep up? Are they going to compete for that college admission or maybe that D1 scholarship, however much of a long shot that might be? It's an arms race, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, I really wish someone, and maybe I'll do this one day, would figure out what the investment would be if parents took the money they put into their kids' sports and put it into, you know, an index fund or something, and over 10 years and saw what that ballooned to versus what they're going to get out on the other end of it. Because, you know, 2% of high school athletes, first of all, only 6% of high school athletes even play sports in college. Only 2% get any kind of scholarship money at all. You know, if that's why you're doing it, it's really playing the lottery.
You're worried about the kids mainly, but you also talk about the stress that the travel, the time, the money puts on parents and families. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I really think it's kind of an underappreciated problem how much sports have kind of taken over family life. It's like it's kind of an alternate universe for those families that are involved in it, where, you know, if there's a two-parent household, there's a lot of dividing and conquering. One parent drives the son to Virginia for a lacrosse tournament, and the mother drives the daughter to Connecticut for a soccer tournament. There's just a lot of disruption in families and also for siblings who, you know, somehow are either dragged along or expected to follow along. It's not all good by any means. And it's hard. It can be hard on marriages. We have little data on that. But if you ask around, you can see that there's no way it can't have an effect on marriages and on family finances.
We're talking to Linda Flanagan, journalist, former track and cross-country coach, with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you one of these families that's gone all in on youth sports? Did it creep up on you? Did you find yourself spending more money, more time on sports? If you are a youth yourself, if you're into sports, do you feel a lot of pressure or are you able to have fun doing it? And how about the atmosphere at kids' games? A lot of people yelling at the referees, arguing with the coaches, overcoaching from the parent sidelines. What are you seeing? How can we fix it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Linda Flanagan about her new book. It's Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids Sports and Why It Matters. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your own experience with youth sports as a parent, a family member, a coach, a referee, maybe a young person yourself. Do you see problems? What still makes it worthwhile if you think it is? Are there changes you'd like to see, whether it's behavior of parents on the sidelines or bigger changes in the whole system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Kathy in Deerfield, who says her kids are grown. They raised them back in the 80s now. And back then when they were in club sports, Kathy says they were upset. The coaches at club sports are upset that the kids took the summer off and that the kids played multiple sports. So this has been around for a while. Linda, this is a story you've run into a lot. Why are you playing another sport? Yes. Why are you taking time off of our sport and things like that?
Yes, yes. And that's only gotten worse. I mean, it's even just over the last decade, you know, clubs and private teams are expecting athletes to not only play during the summer, but, you know, by the way, play what would traditionally be considered a spring sport in the fall and the winter too. There's just more heaped on kids and their families, more expectations. And it's very hard to resist. So, you know, kudos to the mom who did, because it's hard to resist that kind of pressure.
Thanks for that call, Kathy. Another consequence we haven't gotten into that you're right about, Linda, is risk of injuries, often, especially if we overdo just one sport. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, I mean, the medical people I spoke to, the sports doctors, the common word they used was epidemic. They said there's an epidemic of overuse injuries. And I should add, overuse injuries are completely preventable. They're just from using, various parts of the body too much for too long. It's repetitive use. There is an epidemic of overuse injuries. And in Tommy John surgery, we all know about that. I spoke to an orthopedic doctor who said he's been performing this surgery on 12-year-olds. There are more stress fractures, growth plate injuries, injuries to knees and tendons. You know, for young women, there's the female athlete triad. These sort of what you could consider chronic or kind of debilitating injuries, like overuse injuries. And then there are also the more catastrophic ones like ACL tears, which have become an enormous problem. They're devastating injuries that to the knee, and it puts kids on the sidelines for 6 to 12 months and gets them out of their sport. And what I found, I was shocked to discover that doctors are saying that half of the people who tear their ACLs will have arthritis in that knee in 10 years. You know, and in my community, it seems like every other week I'm hearing about usually a girl, often a middle school girl, another girl on the team, on the lacrosse team, tore her ACL. Well, if that girl is 12 or 13, she could be hobbling around, you know, at 23 with arthritis. So it's not just a short term. It's not just, this season you're on the sidelines. It can have, longer term consequences down the road.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jesse is with us in Madison. Jesse, hello. Sorry, Jesse, your connection is not great. Jesse told our call screener he's been coaching for 17 years, seen a transition of kids' sports into almost semi-pro. Parents are praying their kids go pro, and parents give them lots of instructions on where and when to play their kid. Do you hear this a lot from coaches, Linda?
Oh, God. I mean, that's so typical. It's just, they're like the parents have become like agents on the sidelines to some extent. And it is just, very counter to what youth sports are supposed to be for, which is children's development and appreciation for sports. A vanishingly small number of kids are going to go on to play professionally. It's, this idea that somehow if the parent yells the right instruction on the sideline, it's going to make the difference is simply wrong. And it is not helpful to either the child or the coach.
Thanks for calling in, Jesse. Sorry we lost you there at 800-642-1234. Talk to Linda Flanagan about youth sports. Her book is called Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. Still time for you to share your story, your question, maybe your solutions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Linda, let's talk about some of your solutions. One big one that I guess you even suggest we won't hold our breath on is getting rid of college sports as we know it and going to club and intramural sports. As a thought exercise, what would that look like? How would it help?
Well, I mean, just imagine for a minute if college sports were run the way high school sports are, so that kids, you know, if they wanted to join the football team or the tennis team, they tried out at the start of the season. They arrive on campus and then they decide they're going to try out for the team and the coach picks them. I mean, it's so alien to the way it's done now with this giant and expensive recruiting process. But if you had tryouts, say, but you still had intramural sports and you had club sports, so kids could still play, the incentive structure for the club teams and the privatization of youth sports and commercialization of it would evaporate, because much of what drives some of the nonsense is this hope that kids will be recruited and perhaps they'll get into a better college. That would eliminate the problem. But again, I'm not holding my breath. It's not going to happen.
Let's bring out another caller now. Reed is with us in Whitewater. Reed, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about?
I was curious your thoughts about the mental health issues that also come with very competitive sports at a young age. When I was playing soccer competitively, it was just destructive to have coaches and parents just rail on other kids / yell at kids who are 12, 11, 10, and just tell you, you know, you suck. You have to go join another team. You're kicked off the team. Why not?
Reed, thanks for the call. Linda, again, probably more common than we'd like, the mental health impact.
I mean, it's just so terrible. And I it still shocks me that we kind of allow this, that, you know, we have this carve out for atrocious behavior in sports that we just would never dream of allowing in the classroom or the workplace. And I think, you know, we are seeing more attention being paid to this at the college level, because we've had some, you know, some terrible suicides over the past year or so. And it's called attention to the fact that, you know, it's certainly at the college level, there's so enormous amount of pressure and stress and sleep deprivation that goes on. And it's just, that is kind of trickling down, certainly to high school too, where kids feel a ton of pressure. And, you know, I want to add, some kids can take it. Some kids love it. They thrive on that competitiveness. But, you know, a good portion is too much for them.
Thanks for that call, Reed. You've got a lot of solutions in the book, Linda, for parents and families. I want to look at the community level for a moment. You highlight some communities that have rethought how they approach youth sports. What are some of the best lessons we could do at that level?
Well, I think if you look at, say, the high school, there's a high school I profile, Tuscarora High School in Maryland, that has shifted the way it views sports, in that it's not just all after school. They do intramural and they have intramural classes, sports during the day. They offer a lot of club programs. They offer programs for kids with disabilities, physical and intellectual. And their purpose is inclusion. And, you know, it is just it's a healthier environment. 53% of the kids at that school participate in sports. And, you know, there are ways to kind of shift it from this ultra serious, win at all costs, you know, short-term success that is the kind of defines youth sports now.
And that raises a really big point here, Linda. One consequence of all of this doesn't have anything to do with the kids who are in these high-pressure sports environments. We have lots and lots of kids who don't get much exercise, who aren't involved in these group activities. How do we make sure we get them out there too?
I know. Well, that's the, you know, one of the terrible consequences of this commercialization is that, you know, so many kids are just edged out of sports. It's like entirely participation in sports is essentially class-based. And, you know, some some people in leadership positions are striving to correct that. I profile in the book a woman named Monica Wallace, who's a council member in New York State, and she lobbied when Governor Cuomo introduced legislation to allow for mobile sports betting. She lobbied to include a provision that would carve out $5 million every year to go to low-income areas where children are denied or don't have access to sports. So that there are, you know, around the edges, there are efforts being made to where among, you know, leaders and people who have some authority who can address this to kind of to repair it on the margins. And, you know, that's just one state. I believe other states have taken similar steps.
Linda, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Linda Flanagan. She's a freelance journalist, researcher, and former track and cross-country coach. She was with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Take Back the Game, How Money and Mania Are Ruining Kids' Sports and Why It Matters. There is still time for you to share your experiences, negative or positive. If you were involved in a team, a community that you think got things right, love to hear about that. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Again, look for the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org, to share your experiences in youth sports, for better or for worse. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, art and music education has been part of schools for decades, and there's been new movement toward STEAM education, adding art into science, technology, engineering, and math. There's a good chance you took art classes throughout elementary and middle school, maybe beyond. But our next guest says we can take things further and breathe new life into schools if we use the arts to rethink and ultimately save our education system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you value having art and music classes in schools? What did it do for you, you think, as a person? And did your non-art classes encourage creativity in some way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Erica Halverson is a professor of curriculum and instruction at UW-Madison's School of Education and the mayor of Whoopin' Soccer, a youth arts program based in Madison. Erica is the author of How the Arts Can Save Education, Transforming Teaching, Learning, and Instruction. She recently started a podcast. It's called Arts Educators Save the World. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with an important distinction here. I think when I think of art classes, I think elementary school, we took a break, walked over to art class, did art. Or high school, I took as many band classes as I could. You're talking about something different, though, kind of having an artistic mindset, I think, behind education. Can you talk about that?
Sure. First of all, I want to say that I also think about the concept of the arts more inclusively, to consider any kinds of disciplines where people produce things. So the performing arts, the visual arts, the media arts, all are encompassed under this umbrella of arts and arts education and art making. And then also to talk a little to your point about art making, not just as a distinct and separate task from the quote unquote real work of school, but of artistic ways of knowing and doing and being as central to what it means to teach and to learn and to become human across all the spaces where we think about education and schooling.
Can you paint us a picture of what that might look like in the classroom?
Sure. So one of the core things that we learn when we make art is how to create representations. That is, how to take an idea, a concept, a story, and retranslate it using the medium of a particular art form. So a painting is a representation. A theatrical performance is a representation. A TikTok video is a representation. The same core mechanism that we value in art making is exactly what we hope our learners across all of our disciplines can learn to do in school. So a math equation is also a representation. It uses the tools of mathematics to communicate a complicated idea that is difficult to share using other mechanisms of communication. So my vision for reinvigorating life and creativity into schools is to recognize how the arts give young people access to the kinds of practices that we really care about that they do in all of their schooling lives across the full school day. So it might look like a project that stretches across the visual arts classroom and the mathematics classroom. It might look like using some of the tools of teaching in improvisation and applying those to the science classroom. It might be something as simple as giving kids the opportunity to take risks in their classroom space that they might not otherwise take without working together around an artistic process in order to get free them up to do the disciplinary academic work in the other parts of their school day.
You just mentioned risk-taking, and I wanted to talk about that a little, because, you know, at various points in my schooling and professional life, the main thing I wanted to do was not be wrong.
Yeah.
And that isn't always the most conducive to learning stuff. Can you talk about the value of risk-taking and the opportunity to be wrong?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges we face in the current failure-focused environment of schooling is how do we communicate both to kids, but also to educators, that failure is a part of learning and not a lack of learning. How do we encourage learning environments, that is classrooms, after-school spaces, sports teams, interactions between tutors and students? How do we encourage them to think about trying new things, trying ways of knowing, putting out there ideas that you may or may not believe to be ultimately the best answer as part of what it means to do learning? And learning to take risks is the most effective mechanism for that. And for better or worse, as you probably know, and as all listeners know, you can't simply say to people, okay, now it's time to take risks, and magically people open up toward risk taking. You have to, what we call in education speak, scaffold their capacity for risk taking. And I love the scaffolding metaphor because it invokes images of a building held up at first by an external set of tools that then slowly are taken away as the infrastructure for the building is built and can then stand on its own. And so in my book and in my work with arts educators, I talk a lot about what are the kinds of scaffolds that arts practices allow us to build so that we can eventually take them away and embed risk-taking into the everyday practices of teaching and learning.
Talking to Erica Halverson from the UW-Madison School of Education. New podcast called Arts Educators Save the World. You could join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about arts and creativity, how to get them into the classroom, not just the art classroom or music classroom, but all day long. If you're a teacher, what do you think of the ideas you're hearing? Are you able to do this? Have you found ways to do this in your own classes? As a student, past or present, were there teachers, were there classes that really stimulated your creativity And did it help you learn more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Erica, this new podcast, Art Educators Save the World, just out last week. Want to listen to a bit of it? Lin-Manuel Miranda on here and Robert Lopez and their teacher, Barbara Ames, in a conversation. Here's Lin-Manuel Miranda talking about a life-changing teacher.
It was life-changing for me. I think the direct education we got from Barbara wanting us to like go headlong into running our own show and the empowerment that comes with student-run theater, because I saw from seventh grade onward what could be done. And then I directed West Side Story my senior year for musical rep. And I grabbed the stuff from the movie I wanted too. I did the Boy Girl America. I swapped Krupke and Cool. I went to the Barbara Ames School of Make the Best Show Possible for Your Students.
Also, I believe your teacher, Barbara Ames, was the let's put on a show model of teaching. Can you talk a little bit about what you got out of that conversation?
Oh, so many things. I mean, not to sell my own radio, but I would encourage everyone to subscribe and listen to these amazing conversations. The idea behind the podcast in general is successful artists talking with their mentors about the impact that arts education has had on their lives. And we started with Lin-Manuel Miranda and Bobby Lopez because they had the same transformational elementary school music teacher as did I. And we, all of us, attribute the kinds of experiences that Barbara Ames gave us directly to the kinds of human beings we became. And part of that was Barbara's commitment to engaging all of us in the process of making theater and making music. Part of it was the ways in which she encouraged us to take risks in our own artistic lives as pretty young children. You know, she was our teacher when we were in kindergarten through sixth grade. And you heard a little bit from Lynn, and the same is true for myself. And, you know, if listeners don't know Robert Lopez's name just from hearing it, he is the co-writer of Frozen, the movie soundtrack and musical, along with several other Broadway musicals. So these are incredibly accomplished composers, songwriters, some of the greatest of the 21st century. And Barbara is the one who gave us access to our creative selves as young children and encouraged us to carry that forward through creative projects in our schooling lives beyond our time with her, as Lynn said, into high school, both of them obviously into college. And for myself, as an artist turned academic, thinking about the relationship between the stories that she helped me figure out how to tell and improving other people's lives through education, it is an unmatched set of experiences that we got through our education with Barbara.
We're talking to Erica Halverson, professor at UW-Madison School of Education, author of the book, How the Arts Can Save Education. Her new podcast, we were just talking about it, is called Arts Educators Save the World. She joined us to talk about her research on the value of art in schools and not just in separate art classes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you find in your schooling, say, a teacher, a class, a style of teaching that helped boost your creativity? And did that help you grasp difficult topics along the way? If you're a teacher yourself, do you find ways to encourage creativity in your students? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Erica Halverson, UW-Madison education professor, author of the book, How the Arts Could Save Education, with us today to talk about research on the importance of using art in the classroom, not just in the art classroom. You can join in at 800-642-1234 to share your experience. Maybe your questions for our guest about how to put some of these ideas into practice. Again, 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Michael is with us in Spring Green. Michael, hi.
Hi. I was just mentioning the fact that I'm a professor emeritus, taught at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for many decades in the art department. And I had students, young adults from all kinds of different fields that were in my classes, different majors, everything from computer science to medicine. And I always expected that out of the group, maybe one would become an artist. But what I think the arts really contributes to a bigger picture is the idea that the critique and criticism is a very valuable skill. And it encourages critical thinking, which can apply to just about any profession. And I think art people that have art backgrounds, see things differently than just any other person does. And it's because of that ability to see things in different ways that they can apply those skills to just about any profession.
Michael, thanks for the call. Erica, what do you think?
Yeah, I that Michael was not a plant, although I think very well could have been. Critique practice is a great technique for engaging teachers who maybe aren't arts teachers in some of the ways of knowing and doing that we really value in the arts. In my own classes at the university, I teach folks who are planning to become teachers, and I also teach folks who are artists who want to become teaching artists, that is, teach in their lives, but maybe not become certified classroom teachers. And one of my favorite days is a day I call Getting Beyond Good Job, which is where we learn how to talk to one another about the work that we make to develop some of those critique skills that Michael was talking about. So learning to notice, that is engaging with a piece of artwork, whether that's a piece of visual art or performance art, and learning to notice things in the work is an excellent mechanism for developing a teaching and learning technique that can be utilized across different disciplines, because it allows us to engage with one another's work without evaluation, first of all, and by giving the kind of productive feedback that allows people to improve on their representations, on the ways in which they're communicating ideas to each other.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Erica, for somebody wanting to put that idea into practice, I think we hear words like critique and criticism and think, here's how the thing you did was bad. And that's clearly not what you're talking about. For somebody, maybe a teacher out there listening who wants to do this in the classroom tomorrow, what could that look like?
Yes. So there, I mentioned learning to notice. I have a very simple set of questions that I use to teach about critique that I've adapted from Harvard Project Zero, which is a very well-known kind of arts education research house around the country. And they have a lot of free resources on their website. But my kind of simplified version of critique is having people present work to one another and asking everyone to respond to the questions, what do you notice? What does this remind you of? And what do you still want to know? And the reason I like those questions is that they surface the parts of someone's work that stand out to others without any evaluative language associated with it, right? So for example, someone might notice the vibrant colors in a painting. That doesn't mean you like the vibrant colors, you don't like the vibrant colors, but you notice those colors. And that is an opportunity for feedback and conversation, where the artist can say, yeah, I was really thinking the vibrant colors could do A, B, or C. Or, you know, I hadn't really intended for vibrant colors. I see that everyone is noticing that. Here are the kinds of changes I'm going to make to this work in order to make the colors less vibrant so that that is not the first thing that people notice when they examine my work.
Talking to Erica Halverson, professor at UW-Madison School of Education. Erica has a new podcast called Arts Educators Save the World, talking about creativity in our schools. Erica, something that always strikes me, you know, when I think back to my math education, a lot of it was a chore, drudgery in a lot of ways. And then when I interview mathematicians, they're talking about how much creativity goes into problem solving and how much they play with numbers. I mean, they're doing hard stuff too. How do we get that spirit from the pros and bring it into the stuff that K through 12 kids are getting?
Oh, that is such a great question. You know, I have also heard that from mathematicians. And you hear all the time about the connections between making math and making music, making math and making art. There's some really exciting research around how very old arts practices like weaving are highly mathematized. And there's incredible research going on that starts with the mathematized arts practices and uses those practices as a mechanism to move toward some of the more standard representational tools that we use in math classes. So I would say step one begins with identifying the arts practices that are themselves mathematical. And rather than requiring we start with the standardized math practices and require students pass through those before, quote unquote, getting to the good stuff. What if we started with the good stuff and used those opportunities as a way in to the standardized mathematics practices?
We just have a couple minutes left, and I don't want to get out of this without talking about whooping soccer. Sure. I was going to try to describe it to people, and I don't think I have the right words. What is whooping soccer? What do you do?
Yep. So Whoopin' Soccer is a community arts outreach program that's based here in Madison, Wisconsin. We are an artist in residence program. So we bring professional teaching artists into third and fourth grade classrooms. And we work with an entire grade of students on creative expression through writing and improvisation and performance. We each week brings a different theme for creative expression, from writing and telling stories from pictures to telling true stories, to learning a little about playwriting and the tools of playwriting as a form of expression, to writing arguments that allow young people to make change in their world. We give them opportunities to write together, to write alone, to dictate, to perform each other's stories. And then at the conclusion of the residency, our group of teaching artists, many of whom are also professional performers in the Madison community, create an entirely original vaudeville-style sketch comedy show of the kids' work, and we bring the kids to the Madison Youth Arts Center, and they all have an opportunity to see their work performed on a professional stage by professional artists as a mechanism of validating their ideas as not only creative, but valuable for the community at large.
And in just our last few moments, Erica, it's a new school year. Leave us with a bit of encouragement.
It's a new school year. I think all of us are entering it with a bit of trepidation. I like to lead with joy. I like to lead with the idea that coming together in community to make new ideas is an act of joy. And arts practices are the best way I know to infuse joy into our learning systems. So I would say, let's start the year with joy by valuing the artistic ways of knowing and doing that kids naturally bring to learning. And let's lift those mechanisms of expression up as valid, as valued, and as a way to bring all kids productively into our learning environments.
Erica, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Erica Halverson, professor at the UW-Madison School of Education and mayor of Whoopin' Soccer, a youth arts program we were just talking about based in Madison. Erica is the author of the book, How the Arts Can Save Education, Transforming Teaching, Learning, and Instruction. She just launched a podcast. It's called Arts Educators Save the World. And you could still share your stories of creativity in teaching and learning, maybe an art class or a creative teacher who inspired you at some point along the way. You can let us know about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also email ideas@WPR.org.